You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Too frequently or that come from a distance, so we like to give you a little bit of sustenance so you can find your way home. It'll be taking place downstairs. We're having some cool chili. I guess that's probably an oxymoron, isn't it, right? Cool chili and refreshments in the church hall following the service. As well, following the lunch, we're doing the Courage to Be, which is that dialogue that we've engaged in around what it is that we see ourselves doing. I'll talk about that in just a sec. Over the past week, we've been meeting as part of the Courage to Be process to try and discern what it is that we want to be, what is our relationship to the United Church. And as we've done that, I've noticed a number of conversations that bring forth our mission statement. And I've talked to a few folks, and it's not something that we hold up often enough. So I wanted to put that up there and just share it with you once again this morning. Our mission statement is moved by reverence for life to seek justice for all. We inspire one another to seek truth, live fully, care deeply, and make a difference. So my hope this morning is that we can all find a nugget of inspiration in what is being said here this morning and what is being done here this morning. Thank you. Please enjoy our gathering.
There is, out in the lobby, you'll find a notice about a fundraiser we're doing in May. It's a fundraiser for our refugee family. Many of you know that we have supported Raihan Abir and his partner, Samia Hossein, who arrived from Bangladesh. Raihan's co-author, editor, and publisher have all been murdered as a result of their secular thinking. And so he fled to Canada and has now been welcomed as a refugee. So we are continuing to raise funds for them. And on May 7th, a dear friend of mine, Michael George, who is a phenomenal award-winning singer and songwriter, is going to come and provide a concert as a fundraiser. We have some very creative ways for you to attend. You can come for $5 or for $250, and hopefully we'll be able to raise some money for them and continue to establish them in their Canadian citizenship.
Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship we have with the First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government that came out of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. And we expect to complete the reading of all of these recommendations next year in June. Today we read recommendation number 23. We call upon all levels of government to increase the number of Aboriginal professionals working in the healthcare field, to ensure the retention of Aboriginal healthcare providers in Aboriginal communities, and to provide cultural competency training for all healthcare professionals.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
This is a time we focus on what we are grounded upon, and I was looking at the pictures of the earthquake in Taiwan just recently, and so much of what we try to do is ground ourselves on something that's dependable. And I'm sure a lot of buildings in Taiwan are built to withstand things like that, and some didn't. And so that crumbled. I don't know if you saw the pictures, but it's just tragic that a rumble can go through a town and end so much of what is alive there. And so when we talk about grounding ourselves, it has to be on something that we could take from this room here and share with everyone, and it would apply. So it can't be that the universe is all going to work out right, and it can't be that someone's going to take care of everything. It can't be that. And a lot of the hard work of this is realizing what it can't be. But what it can be is exactly what did happen, that we are part of life. and it has an impact on us, sometimes a horrific one, sometimes a beautiful one. And we have an impact on life, sometimes a horrific one and sometimes a beautiful one. And that is true. And that is the stand we take as ground, and then we say, well, how then shall we live? And we try and we try to live lovingly in that reality. And we stumble and we fall and we succeed and we're triumphant. We're such a mix. But that's the beauty of that. And so we gather together to share wisdom, to do that a little better each time. I've asked the vocal ensemble to introduce the song you know, you may know well, but I've thrown another descant on top, and that does two things. That makes it a little harder to sing, which is part of life, and it also adds something else, and that's part of what helps in that struggle to love, is someone else joining you.
I'd like to offer you now some words of inspiration from a number of authors. Antoni Michaelis is an award-winning novelist and storyteller. She was born in Germany in 1979, and she spent her childhood and adolescence surrounded by crazy, likable parents and various cats. She began writing stories at a very early age and has recently finished studying medicine. For the time being, she's dedicated herself to crafting children's books. And this reading this morning is an excerpt from one of her recent novels, The Storyteller. My child, I know you're not a child, but I still see you running wild between those blooming trees. Your sparkling dreams and silver laugh, your questions of the stars above are just a memory. And in your eyes, the ocean. And in your eyes, the sea. The waters frozen over with your longing to be free. Yesterday, when you'd awoken, the world seemed incredibly old. This is the age you are broken, or turned into gold. You had to kill a child, I know, to break the arrow and the bow, to shed your skin and change. The trees are flowering no more. There's blood upon the marble floor. This place is dark and strange. I see you standing in the storm, holding the curse of youth. Each of you with your story. Each of you with your truth. Some words will never be spoken. Some stories never be told. This is the age you are broken or turned into gold. I didn't say the world was good. I hope by now you understood why I could never lie. I didn't promise you a thing. Don't ask my winter voice for spring. Just spread your wings and fly. Though in the hidden garden, down by the green, green lane, the plant of love grows next to the tree of hate and pain. So take my tears as a token. They'll keep you warm in the cold. This is the age you are broken or turned into gold. You've lived too long among us to leave without a trace. You've lived too short to understand a thing about this place. Some of you just sit there smoking, and some already sold. This is the age you are broken or turned into gold. This is the age you are broken or turned into gold. And the following is an excerpt from Michael Jackson. It's a poem that he wrote, and it's found in a book he wrote in 1992. It's called Dancing the Dream. And the title of the poem is Innocence. And that's what innocence is. It's simple and trusting like a child, not judgmental and committed to one narrow point of view. If you're locked into a pattern of thinking and responding, your creativity gets blocked. You miss the freshness and magic of the moment. Learn to be innocent again, and that freshness never fades. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
We're in the middle of our Academy Awards series inspired by Hollywood. We've watched a couple of movies, and today I'm talking about Room, which I didn't actually get to see until Thursday night. So I had started the focus moment, had the first like couple of lines written, and then came home after the movie and completed it, wondering how on earth I would ever talk about that film, because it was such a challenging movie to watch. So I try to begin talking about it in this focus moment. It was a big world, and we consumed it with open-eyed innocence, laughing at wiggly worms, playful new puppies, and water rippling over our fingers. We built relationships with everything. All we explored added up to everything, and everything fit neatly inside all we explored. It was reality, perfectly balanced by necessity. Except that it wasn't, never is, never will be real. Once truth, the truth, a truth, any truth, seizes us, delusion implodes like so many shattered mirrors, and we stumble, disoriented by the ever biggerness of what we find exposed, what lay beyond the doors we could not see. Everything no longer squeezes into all we ever knew. It, we, are come too big for perfect balances. It is a big world. Too big for me, too big for you, too big for even two of us. Let's find the others then and be free. So, Room. Yeah, well, we've been doing this inspired by Hollywood series for a number of years now, and several times I've thought, what have I chosen? Because the movies are always chosen based on, approved for 14A audiences. And so we have seen some pretty graphic films. Precious was one of the first ones. I remember some people in the congregation, I got a phone call saying, we don't watch this kind of stuff. It was probably one of the most redemptive movies I've watched, but brutal in its telling. I remember contacting John about, I think it was The Wolf of Wall Street, saying, do I really want to tell people to watch this movie? We had been advertising it, and John said, I don't think we can start censoring at this point. And, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, like, we have not held back. And this year, I kind of wondered about whether or not I really wanted to continue to support the Academy because of its lack of representation, no women directors, no black actors, like, anything in the award nominations. It was jarring. And then this, I love it when governments come up with climate goals that they're going to meet by 2050. Like, hello? What is that? But the Academy is going to be more inclusive by 2020. Like, hello, what happened to today? So I've really been thinking about whether or not to continue to use the Academy Award nominations as a theme, but maybe just ask people for their favorite movies and we'll just do six of your favorite movies over the course of that week. And Room really drove that question home and has really challenged me about whether or not we should be sharing these kinds of movies. The point is we need to share them because we need to talk about them. But the thing about the process is I don't read anything about the movie until I actually go and see the movie. And then I read a bunch of reviews, try to read stuff by Canadian reviewers. I read a little bit about the actors, about the author of the book, if there's a book. And because I didn't get to see the movie till Thursday night, I was cramming all of that into Friday and Saturday. And I didn't actually look at any reviews because I was stunned by just the information that I got about the story and who it was written about or what triggered it and what's happened in the last couple of weeks. Emma Donoghue is an Irish-Canadian author who wrote the book Room. Many of you may have read that Room. So the story is adapted. The screenplay was written by Emma Donoghue, who wrote the book. She also wrote the screenplay. And the story is about a woman, played by Brie Larson, who is kidnapped by a man when she's 17 on her way home from school. He says he has a sick puppy. She goes to help. And he imprisons her in this room, in a garden shed that he has prepared, completely soundproofed. It has a skylight, a toilet, a sink, a bathtub, and a small refrigerator. And he repeatedly rapes her, and she gets pregnant, gives birth to this child, Jake, who, when the movie opens, is having his fifth birthday. So we know that they have been there at least 5 years. During the time, she pretends that he's sick by heating up water and putting it around his face after they've had the power turned off for several days at a time to teach them a lesson by old Nick, the man who had kidnapped her. And so she takes that opportunity, recognizing that because there was no heat, Jake could have got very sick, and Jacob Tremblay is unbelievable as this child. He acts profoundly in this movie. I always wonder what happens to child actors that have to participate in these kinds of films, but he is remarkable in his acting. So she takes this boiling water and she puts it on his face to make his face hot. She doesn't burn him, but she makes him hot so that when old Nick comes in that night, he can feel him and feel that he's very, very sick and perhaps take him to the hospital. That's what she's hoping. She puts a little note in his pocket so that when he gets to the hospital, he can hand that to someone and they can save him. But it doesn't work. Old Nick doesn't fall for it. So she has to come up with another plan. And the next plan is that he's dead. That Jake dies. So she rolls him up in the carpet, which you see on the trailer, and he comes in. She tells him, she screams at him that he has killed her son, and Nick takes the boy away in the carpet to dispose of him. But in the truck, Jake does what his mom told him, rolls and rolls and wiggles, and when they get to a stop sign, jumps out, and the story unfolds. It's gripping and it's powerful, and I sobbed. You know, it was when I was preparing to do this movie last Sunday after our Courage to Be conversation, I talked about how I'd use it as this great metaphor of being in a box and breaking out into our freedom, and ha ha ha. But it was so raw that using it as that kind of a metaphor seemed far too simplistic. Yes, we see that we are caught in boxes, and yes, we see that we need to escape. But perhaps the poem that John read you that talks about how you have to be broken, there's something that happens, your innocence needs to be killed in order for you to be able to move forward, we see that in this movie. We see Jake's innocence being destroyed by his mother in order to bring about a greater freedom. And that's a painful thing to watch, a disorienting thing to watch, almost as disorienting as what the world is once they find their way out. But the thing that troubled me is that the story, Emma Donoghue was gripped to write this story, inspired to write Room, a fictional story, about a real-life situation that had unfolded in 2008. Some of you may remember Elizabeth Fritzl, who had been imprisoned by her father for 24 years in a basement location in her home. Her mother lived upstairs all that time, had no idea that she was there. She had run away at one point and come back, and so he had convinced the police and his wife, the father had convinced the police and his wife that Elizabeth had run away and joined a cult. And during her imprisonment, she gave birth to 7 children. 3 of them were left on the front porch as foundlings with little notes suggesting that they had been brought there by Elizabeth from the cult. She couldn't keep them, so she had brought them. And so her mother, Rosemary, actually raised 3 of the children. One of them died shortly after birth and was incinerated on the property, and the other 3 grew in that space, never being outside until they were let free in 2008. Elizabeth, one of the daughters, had become gravely ill, and she convinced her father that that child should go to the hospital, kind of like the story that unfolds in Room. And he does take her to the hospital, and the social services get a little concerned about this. Some of the things didn't add up, and so they ended up looking into it, and a few days later freed Elizabeth and her other children, one of whom was 2 inches taller than the space in which he had lived his entire life. So he had never learned to stand up. They had not seen the light, and as you see in Room, they have to have special glasses because it's so bright. And just the reality of being in a space larger than that to which one has been confined for one's entire life is a tragic unfolding of the tale. But on January 21st, just a couple of weeks ago, the news broke that a man in Sweden had created a bunker and padded it and filled it and put some furniture in it and kidnapped his first victim and taken her there and had planned to do exactly the same thing. And here's where I have the issue with the movie. Because is the movie, is the story, is it something that creates a copycat culture, or did this, you know, did this guy in Sweden just become inspired by, you know, the story of the Fritzls in Austria and figure he could do it too? Something happened to him, and he became afraid when he found out that the woman had been identified as missing, and the police had been contacted, which I guess he didn't think was going to happen, which reminded me of our missing and murdered Aboriginal women, many of whom weren't noted as missing at the time, and those in society who are on the fringes and whose disappearance we wouldn't see, prostitutes and people who don't have a lot of relationships in community. So maybe the guy in Sweden just thought, you know, maybe I can take advantage of that. But when he found out that someone had actually been noted as not being where they were expected to be and the police were onto them, he gave himself up, which is a relief. But it made me think of the... I'm going to keep this because I might need these notes. It made me think of the movie Natural Born Killers that came out in the 1990s that to date has been identified as probably responsible for at least 32 murders, including the Columbine murders. In the movie, Mickey and Mallory kill Mallory's abusive father and facilitating wife, her mother, and then go on this trip across the continent in this killing spree, killing almost everyone that they come in contact with and leaving one person in each situation to tell what the story was like. And it's supposed to be a satire on our obsession with violence and how the media focuses so much on violence. Because in the movie, one media person gets so caught up in it and so sensationalizes it that it just continues to spur it on in a very dramatic way. But one of the people, Eric Harris, wrote just a couple of days before the Columbine shooting, he was one of the killers, "When I go NBK," which means natural born killers, "when I go NBK and people say things like, oh, it was so tragic, and oh, he's crazy, or it was so bloody, just because your mummy and daddy told you blood and violence is bad, you think it's an effing law of nature? Wrong. Only science and math are true. Everything, and I mean every effing thing else, is man-made. Before I leave this worthless place, I will kill whoever I deem unfit for anything at all, especially life." NBK, going NBK, means just killing, because there are no rules and there is no moral absolute to which we are held. I said I was going to talk about Pancake Tuesday, because that's got to do with this moral absolute. We've lived in a world through much of our evolution that has been ruled by gods and divine beings who have set for us these moral absolutes. And Pancake Tuesday is the opportunity for us to actually say all of those times that we have broken that code, that we have sinned against God, and we can shrive ourselves of all that sin. It's we're shriven once we've actually got rid of all that sin. And it goes to this understanding that sets as our moral absolute something that has been handed down through generations based on an idea of that divine being, because we had to at some point in time put the things that were going to preserve our society up there on some superior being who could mete out justice. So if you stole something, that could have an incredible effect on a very small community if somebody just kept stealing things from somebody else. So they made it morally wrong because of a divine supernatural being who said it was morally wrong. And you could have a hand cut off if you did that. They made it that God was punishing rather than us punishing because it was that bloody serious in order to maintain human community. So we have handed those absolutes down through time. But in the last 100 years, 200 years, they've been unraveling those absolutes. And so we no longer have one code of ethics that we think we all will adhere to. We know what it means to be good, but by whose argument is it good? As Harris said, is it because your mommy and daddy said it was good? Is it because, you know, violence, we say violence is bad? Who cares? There is no moral absolute anymore. We live in a world of moral relativism. And that means that, you know, whatever seems to be appropriate in your culture, if it's acceptable within your culture, it's an acceptable thing. And if it's not acceptable in your culture, then maybe you won't go out of your way to do it. But within culture, we have individuals who decide that they want to do things according to what's good for them, too, rather than what's good for the whole. And so relativism can come down, moral relativism can come down to just what I think myself. Moral relativism means that in situations where female genital mutilation, for instance, is happening, that that's okay because it's culturally appropriate there. And that those of us who think that that's a barbaric custom have nothing to say to that because we aren't part of that culture. That moral imperialism would be us going in and saying, you can't do that. That's like barbaric. So moral relativism sets up these different standards around the world and allows them to self-regulate themselves. They may have Pancake Tuesdays in those places where they recognize they've made some mistakes, but I kind of doubt it. And I don't think that there are opportunities like we used to have where we could all take a big, deep sigh of relief and recognize that we've done nothing wrong or that we're clear of all guilt and we can start again. We're finding that we're getting more to the place where we don't actually think any of us have done anything wrong, because we've made choices that have been good for us, and in a morally relativistic world, that's okay. So how do we embrace these questions of what is right and what is wrong in that kind of a world? And this is where I get passionate about what we do here, because I think what we have to do is create communities that identify what is morally right and what is morally wrong. And we have articulated that here for many years. The last 12, 13 years, we've been doing that very intentionally, talking about what's important to us, talking about how we want to live, reviewing that and updating it, setting values out by which we want to live. If you live in a world of moral absolutes, the only value by which you have to live is obedience. Like, you just have to do what is divinely told to you to do, what a set of scriptures or a set of laws or a set of, you know, acceptable behaviors is. Your only value by which you have to live is obedience, because everything else is told to you that you're supposed to do. But in a system that is constantly in flux, how is it that we find how we want to live? And I believe that we do it by bringing communities together and naming those values. Now, how many of you here, I don't know if you want to put your hands up, you probably don't, but there are probably some of you here that are also members of maybe, you know, investment groups where you get together and you talk about your investments and what would be good to invest in and what, you know, you might want to get rid of. I would be willing to bet that the morality that's discussed in that kind of a group is different than the one that's discussed in this group, which may even be different than one that's discussed in a group of teachers setting a new curriculum, or one that's discussed down at the University Hospital Network, where we're talking about end-of-life issues, beginning-of-life issues and end-of-life issues, and those fine lines and where they lie. Each group comes up with its own understanding of morality, has to, like, argue it out until they have a set of values by which they want to live. And they may not be the same from one place to another in one person's own life, because they deal in very different places. You know, you go to the hockey arena, and if you're a parent of a young child, and you have permission to scream and yell at people and call them all kinds of names. Well, it's kind of getting frowned upon now, but it used to be the norm. I used to stand beside my father, and oh my gosh, the things that he would say. It was just embarrassing. Especially, you know, if you were dating the guy he was yelling at, you know, that was really bad. But anyway, he'd never know. But we compartmentalize in our lives sometimes, thinking we can do something in one place that we can't do in another. And we don't even think about it. We just act that way. So what we do in one place without thinking that it's something that we do in another place doesn't seem to bother us. It's like, you know, we're just two different people, super compartmentalizers when it comes to morality. Except that we can't be that. We can't do that. We end up having climate goals for 2050 if we do that. Because if we're working hard on something and we look busy, isn't that good enough? You know? We can't afford a morally relativistic world. We have to allow one, but we can't afford one. Do you get the difference there? We have to allow that people get to make their own choices, but we can't afford that everybody be able to make their own choices. Not if we're trying to protect life on this planet. Not if we're trying to create a sustainable future. Not if we're trying to, you know, even if we wipe out the human family, you know, to allow some other life forms to continue, you know. And if we're going to wipe out the human family, I mean, don't we want to go down in a nice way rather than in a, you know, let's kill each other way? I don't have the answers to those questions. I don't know how we do that. But I think that creating communities that talk about these things is essential. Over the course of the last 50 years, liberal mainline denominations, which had a tempering effect on social fabric because they brought kind of liberal ideas, liberal perspectives. They created a buffer between, you know, crazy out there lefties and the histrionically conservative right thinkers. They created that buffer and brought the two into conversation very often. They influenced politically. They participated in a community way. They drew people together and talked about those important things. Over time, they seemed to get more and more anachronistic, and so people would come into church on a Sunday and hear all about, you know, how they were supposed to live, and then they'd go out and the rest of the week they don't live like that. And you hear stories like that all the time. But communities that are transforming people are communities that are talking about how we want to live with one another. What are the values that we choose to hold up, and how do we reinforce those? How do we embrace one another when we try to do that? Because it's bloody hard. It's very hard to live up to those values. Anybody who's like written or read Vision Works, those people who participated even in writing the first document which states the values by which we want to live, recognized how daunting that responsibility was to try to live like that. It's incredibly hard. And so how do you create a community that inspires people to live like that? And then how do you create a community that when people fail at that, which we're going to do, that embraces those people and holds them in the midst of that lament, who helps them articulate when they've fallen short of that. Give them permission and safe passage to talk about what it's like when you fail to live up to your own ideals articulated by the community you're engaged in. And how do you create community that once you've done that can call you back to recommit, to find your way back to the possibilities of working toward living in right relationship? I picked up Martin Buber's I and Thou again this week and was reading part of the preface by Walter Kaufman, and he noted how people speak all the time about Buber's I, Thou, which without actually reading it, because it's such a simple concept, and it is a simple concept. It's that we can live in the world with an I-I relationship, that I'm about me and you're about me too. Thank you very much. That's an I-I relationship. We can live in a world that's a we-we relationship where, you know, we're all, you know, there's no real differentiation. We're all in this together. We can live in a world where it's an I-it relationship, where I'm using you to attain some particular gains, or we can live in a world where everything out there is sacred. Sacred in the sense of being so crucial, so intimately woven into the web of life that if it were to be eradicated, or if we were to destroy it or mitigate its influence on us, if we were to deny that sacred element of it, we would not be living in right relationship. And that's Buber's I-Thou relationship. When I speak to you as though you are divine, and you speak to me as though I am, and we treat the piano as though it is, and all life forms on the world as though they are, then we create this I-Thou relationship, which is essential to finding our way toward a sustainable future for all, or essential to our going down as one of those 99% of species that have come into being on this planet that are now extinct. If we go down like that, we do it honoring and loving and caring for one another on the way down, not just fighting to be the last one standing. Who on earth would want that anyway? So Room took me to a conversation about moral relativism and a recognition about how important community is, despite the fact that it was about a box and living in a box, and the reality that a woman who created life for her child for 5 years, sharing with him that that was the entirety of the world, that it held beauty, that it held possibility, that it held love, that it held anger, that it held frustration and learning, that it held opportunity, that space, that those maybe 60 square feet, that they were space enough for love, was good enough for them until it wasn't good enough. This is good enough for us. It'll inspire us. It'll give us that breath we need to take for the rest to get through the rest of the week. It will give us all of the values that we need to live by, and it will call us to account when we fail that. It will recommit us, and it will send us back out into the world confident in the way that we're living. But it is a box, and it is not good enough. We have to break away from what confines us in this place and ensure that what it is we are about is what that's about. Because we're big. We're bigger than our space. We're bigger than the laws that we've told ourselves. We're bigger than what it was we thought we could do. What we know doesn't fit into everything, and everything doesn't fit into what we know anymore. I don't know how many times I've told you that you are the light of the world. I don't know how many times I've told you that the future depends on who you are. I don't know how many times I've told you that whatever your story is, whatever that passion that you have in the middle of your heart, of your life, of your recollection of who you've been low these many years, how that story needs to be told. And I don't know how many times I've helped you wrestle with the fact that even telling that story still falls short of what it is you wished to do. I don't know how many times. But I do know that every time you leave this place, you go with who you are, and that is far more than any of us can ever imagine. It's far more than you ever dreamed. It's far more than anything a box could hold. You are the light of the world, and you are the change that needs to happen. Your voice, your heart, your hands. The box is far too small. Thank you. I'm not going to tell you that again. You know, I just told you all that you are the light of the world stuff. But you do go out into a world that is fractured and a world that has so many of those different communities figuring out how to live. And you're part of many of those communities. So be you when you're there and pay attention to what the rules are and how you want to live by those rules or these rules or some other set of rules. And be brave in those places. Because courage is actually one of the most important values. Some say the only important value, the most important. So go out there and be courageous about who you are. Go out there and be light. Go in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.